Welcome to ACMN Conversations, a podcast about marketing, media, and entertainment matters. I'm ACMN's Managing Director, Lyndall Pond, and we are excited to get back into our podcast series for 2022. We thought we'd kick off our year of podcasts with one of the more important conversations in our industry, that of diversity. So we've asked Cecily Stovall to join us. Cecily is an artist, educator, and advocate who connects her theatre and performance practice, expertise as an educator, lived experience as a Black artist, and passion for arts outreach to deliver programming that serves artists and our industry at large. She is currently the Equity and Inclusion Manager at the Malthouse Theatre. Cecily, thank you so much for joining us.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
So Cecily's performed on the Broadway stage as well as here in Australia in the Book of Mormon, which obviously ACMN was heavily involved in. She has a passion for diversity in the arts and has turned her attention to some really great work in this space, which we are really excited to learn more about today. I think there's a really important education piece to be done in our industry. So I'm looking forward to this chat today to help both myself and our listeners to become a little more aware and informed on this topic and how we can be part of the solution to ensure everyone in our industry is heard and seen, both on and off the stage. So I always like to start with a bit of context. So let's get into it by getting your story. Tell us a little bit about yourself and your career on the stage.
Sure. Well, today I find myself on the land of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation, and would begin by paying my respects to elders past, present, and emerging, and acknowledging that this is a land of stories. So, you know, and my story is just one more that is being told here. So thank you so much, Lyndall, for inviting me and giving me the space to share it. As you mentioned in the introduction, my background is in performance, and through, I guess, a bit of curiosity and maybe a slight bit of a plan B planning, started working quite a bit in, you know, what I refer to as arts outreach and trying to investigate pathways and access into the arts. Fast forward a few years, moved to Australia, decided I would stay here for a bit longer. And the questions and curiosities around representation on stage and diversity and inclusion really started to rise up. So marrying my curiosity around diversity and inclusion, my passion for access, my lived experience, you know, as an artist, I think that sort of all has come together to create the work that I'm really passionate about doing now, which is finding ways to support access and inclusion and equity in the arts sector, specifically the performing arts sector.
Yeah, that's so good. I mean, it really is the coming together of a whole series of skills, and they're just colliding in such an important way. So I think we're all grateful for what you bring to this conversation. So from your experience and what you've seen, what do you feel are the key issues that we're facing in Australia with regard to diversity in the arts?
I think diversity, you know, in some circles, it's kind of a dirty word, but the idea of diversity in the arts is a bit of a misnomer, because it makes us think that if we have a wide range of representation of ethnicities or genders or heights or body size on stage, that that's where the end of the work is, and it's actually the beginning. I think that one of the key issues Australia is facing right now is that we are starting to figure out what diversity looks like and what representation looks like on stage, but we're still really working out as an industry, what does inclusion look like? What does equity look like? What does it mean to offer genuine access? What does authenticity in our work and consciousness in the work and acknowledging the identities of the individuals we're working with to make them belong? What does all of that look like? So I think the key issue we have in Australia is that we are a bit behind the eight ball in terms of diversifying either our stages or other artistic forms. And because we're a little bit behind there, we're quite a bit behind on acknowledging how we make inclusion, equity, access, and belonging a part of the story that the diversity will hopefully tell.
Yeah, and like you say, I mean, what happens on the stages is only part of it, and the work that you do, where, you know, in sporting terms at the grassroots level, is actually really important. So I want to talk to you a little bit about Stage of Change, which is the organization that you set up. And I really loved when we were chatting and the research I've done that it's three spokes that are interconnected, as opposed to often these things are pillars, and the plan that you've put in place there. So tell us a little bit more about that.
Sure. Sage of Change started in 2017, and it was really born out of a recognition that there was a lack of representation of artists of color here in Australia. Now, you know, the kind of big asterisk elephant in the room caveat to all of this is that I was brought over to Australia to be a performer. And so there is certainly a privilege in my position. But, you know, I was asking questions like, well, why don't they have actors like me here? Where is the support for actors who look like me or sound like me? And so Stage of Change was born to create professional opportunities for artists of color in Australia, and to help not only give them the training that they needed to be on stage, to perform, to do what they, you know, want to do either on stage or off stage, but also for the industry to find a way to support those artists and for their communities to support them too. So the three spokes of Stage of Change are community engagement, artist training, and industry standards. And I call them spokes because I really don't think that one of them is going to solve the problem. It's really this wheel, if you will, that we've got to start rolling, and all three pieces have to roll together. It has to happen from the young people who get, you know, encouraged to study arts, go to the arts, see theater, see dance from a young age. That comes from the community. It has to come from the tertiary institutions, making space, creating access. It has to come from seeing representation on stage. That comes from the industry. And it also has to come from the artists being trained at a level where they can be competitive, not only with other artists who are of color or other people who have been historically excluded, but that they are equally considered with all artists, so that we elevate the quality of training for those artists as well. So those are the three spokes, and together we're rolling into the motion of change.
I love that analogy. It's really clever. And it just, the all of the examples you gave us then, it doesn't start at the finished product. It needs to start way, way, way back in time, of how we kind of get our kids interested in arts, the same way we get our kids interested in sports. So sure. So much opportunity there. That's fantastic. As you talk, I think this would be really helpful, and would help me, and I'm sure it would help our listeners to get a bit of clarity. There's so many like terms and concepts that you use, whether it's representation, inclusion, identity versus characteristics. There's lots of, I guess we'll call them buzzwords, but they're really meaningful. Can you give us a crash course in some of the terminology that's used?
Absolutely. Okay. Now I have to preface this by saying this is definitely a sneak peek into some of the workshops. So if
you
I don't
it first. Oh, yeah.
So I like to lean into the principles that I refer to as the ABIDE principles. So that's access, belonging, inclusion, diversity, and equity. And I think it's important for organizations to identify how to differentiate those, because so often we say, oh, this is a diversity and inclusion, or this is equity and inclusion. But if we don't really understand what the difference of those is, we start to miss the opportunities for us to support artist communities and our own organizations in specific pillars. So access for me is about the removal of barriers. I mean, access also obviously can be speaking specifically about access for deaf or disabled humans to come into our organizations, but whatever version of it, it's about removing the barriers. Belonging is about recognizing people and their individuality. So that means I recognize that you, Cecily, come to my workplace and you're a mother, and I need to respect your time, and I need to respect the boundaries that you set. You are a Black woman, and I need to watch, ensure that I'm using language that is appropriate. And if not, not asking you to tell me how to do it right. So it's about acknowledging people's identity. That's the belonging. Inclusion is a little different from belonging. Inclusion is really about every role having access to be able to engage within the full realm of the organization. So it means that if I work in the front of house at a theater and there's a problem that's impacting me, that decision is not going to be made by the C-suites, that my voice, my opinion, my perspective as that employee, as that participant in the organization is actually included, that my perspective included. Diversity, as we've spoken about, I like to say it's just a fact. It's like a table. It's like the microphone that we're talking on today. It's a thing. We can measure it. We can look at it. But diversity in itself is not the outcome. Diversity is a thing that is a part of this story. And then equity, the last one, sort of underpins them all. Equity really talks about making sure that the organization is operating in a fair way for everyone. So I used actually this example earlier today that if there's a let's say there's a musical and there's half the cast who's singers and half the cast that's dancers, and the dancers are always on stage and the singers are always in the booth, finding a way that we're equitably recognizing the efforts and impacts of both of those groups of people. Because even if, let's say, the dancers get paid more than the singers, we still need both of them to feel like it is fair in the organization and that their contribution is considered, that their contribution is considered equitably, not equally. Everyone's not treated the same, but that we have a fairness on how we're treating one group of people versus another, or one individual over another, right? So it's this fairness, this equity that underpins our need for access, belonging, inclusion, and to measure diversity within our organizations. Does that all make sense?
It really does. And I think there's a good plug for a stage of change coming now, because they are really complicated issues, and delving into each of those, access, belonging, inclusion, diversity, equity, could be, you know, days of conversation to really get your head around it. I mean, I love that ultimately it's about a sense of fairness, you know, people being seen, people being heard. I like what you said about not equal necessarily, but equitable, being, you know, equity being the difference. But yeah, I mean, in simple terms, it makes lots of sense. And I feel like there's a lot of delving to be done in that. But hopefully this is a conversation that people who are listening can kind of hold a mirror up to, either to themselves or to the organization in which they work, and in broad terms go, are we addressing those things? How are we doing on those five sort of topics?
Right. And I think the great thing about addressing it and identifying the difference between each of those principles is it then allows you to be more focused in your action. So for instance, if you have a cohort of, let's say, people who are working in production or back of house, and they identify that they're doing their work and they're fine, and maybe they're a diverse group of people, but they are calling off work all the time because they're frustrated with what's happening in the job. And we survey them and we identify that it's actually because they don't know who to talk to if they have a problem. So they just don't talk to anyone. That's an issue with inclusion. That means that's the pillar that's missing. But if they say, I know who to talk to, I know where to go, but, you know, I don't really feel like anybody cares about what's going on with me, that's an issue with belonging, right? So we start to identify where these nuances are and where the challenges are, so that we can start to address the problems and not just say, oh, this is a diversity issue. You know, let's bring in some more people and it'll fix itself once we diversify. That's not always a solution.
Yeah, that's so, it's same with any issue, isn't it, right? Get to the root of the problem and you'll be able to find the right solution.
Sure.
And that sort of leads nicely onto sort of my next question, because I think looking at a real example helps us to apply this thinking to what we're all doing in our own organization. So I guess with your knowledge and expertise, you're obviously quite a useful consultant. I know you're doing some work with the Malthouse Theatre in Melbourne at the moment. So maybe using that current role, what does that role do, and how do you kind of fulfill that part of your sort of daily efforts?
Well, Malthouse is a great organization. They identified that they needed support in creating an equity action plan, which came off the back of some work that they did through Multicultural Arts Victoria, the Fair Play program that ran, I think, 2 years ago. And identifying that they needed help was honestly a very brave step, because it can be so easy to feel like you need to be able to do it yourself or you need to keep it in-house. I came in to work as a consultant in April of last year and ended up staying on board for a year contract to help support the implementation of this plan. And I think what we've discovered is that if equity and inclusion is part of the plan, you know, if it sits alongside a strategic plan, or if it's underpinning the organization, it's not enough to write it on a piece of paper or slap it on your website. It really takes some deep diving into the operations of the organization to identify where are equitable practices, where are practices that are inclusive, you know, where are we inhibiting access? It's really granular. It's really, you know, it's, I like to say that it's one part consultancy and probably four parts change management, you know, because there, a lot of the ways that we've done things in the past historically, there are better ways, there are more inclusive ways. And when you say, this is how I'm going to do it, it sometimes needs a steward to help drive that direction.
Yeah. And I can imagine it is not a one size fits all solution. Like I think what you said before about the deep dive into a particular organization and find out which are the bits that are working for them, but which are the bits where there is opportunity for difference and change. You could come up with sort of just this blanket fix and it just isn't actually going to address the problems.
Right.
Do you start by kind of interviewing people? How do you go about it?
Yeah. The best way for me to start understanding an organization is really to just listen. So oftentimes I start with surveys or interviews. I'll meet with leadership. I also like to meet with kind of the middle management, the people who are taking action on the policies or the you know, the culture of the organization, the people who are executing that, and really trying to understand what's happening, where the barriers are. I also like to talk to and speak to ex-employees, people who have left. A lot of times that's where you find mm-hmm. a lot of insight about what's going on and where the challenges are. And just acknowledging that there are power dynamics and there's so much at play in you know, people feeling like they need to be tied to their employer or tied to the person who is paying them. You don't want to speak out about them, but finding the space to have the psychological safety within the workplace to be able to identify where those challenges are. And those power dynamics are exacerbated when you add in identity dynamics, like someone is a person of color, someone is a person of faith, someone is a deaf or disabled human. You know, there are all these other layers that can add into the kind of what's the word I'm looking for? There are all these other factors that can add into the silencing of people's voices. So a lot of times just being a person who's there and letting people have the space to speak can go a long way to learning about what's happening in an organization.
Yeah. And question without notice, when you're doing that research, how do you sort of distinguish between a person's kind of, for want of a better word, baggage that they perhaps bring to the table versus or an experience that they've had either there or at another organization versus an actual cultural issue within the organization that needs to be addressed and needs to be changed?
For me and my methodology, what's been really helpful is by analyzing a survey, not just by what everyone says and averaging the numbers, but kind of looking at the outliers top and bottom, you start to identify, all right, this human has clearly had a bad day or a bad experience, or, you know, like there's, you know, if one's across the board and everyone else is four or fives, that's something different. But when we're at ones and twos and threes, and then a couple of fours and five, you start to see trends establishing. And by asking both quantifiable information as well as anecdotal questions, you know, the story starts to come out. You know, speaking of storytelling, you start to understand the story and the truth. And I think it's important to go back and say that this work, although it oftentimes can sort of fill a function of human resources, this is not HR. This is, you know, an equity and inclusion efforts sit, in my opinion, sort of outside of HR, only because HR should support the implementation of the results of this, of, you know, your equity and inclusion work. But it can't be just the rules of how something is done. It really has to be like the policy and the foundation. It has to be the strategy of the organization. So it has to kind of sit deeper than that. And, you know, in order to be effective, the goal is that the strategies are not just benefiting the people of color, the people who have historically been excluded, the marginalized identities within the organization. It really does elevate everyone. It elevates everyone to be better bystanders, to be better allies, to be better coworkers, to acknowledge you know, the culture ads instead of just looking for the culture fit, you know, it really elevates the organization as a whole.
Yeah, I love that. And as you were talking then, I was thinking, you know, if it's sat in the HR department, it becomes a deliverable of the HR department as opposed to the fabric or the culture of the organization as a whole. And the stuff that's actually really hard to put into words because it is just how you do it. But I love that what you just said then about elevating every person and the organization as a whole, because to me that's equity, right? That's what it's all about.
That's why equity, you know, that's why equity holds it all together.
Yeah, I love it. So is there maybe a real life example where you've influenced the outcome of perhaps a programming or a casting choice because you managed to come at it or help the organization come at it through the eyes of fairness with respect to a group that, using your language, that has historically been excluded?
Sure. I think one of the things I'm quite proud of at Malthouse, which, you know, depending on who you ask and who had to do the work, they might have varying opinions, but we instituted general auditions this year for the first time in quite a while. And, you know, from an artist, you know, if I'm speaking just as my, I'm an actor hat and I want to have general auditions, it seems like, you know, why isn't every theater doing this? Why don't they want to get to know people? But it's a lot of work. There's a lot of hurdles. There's a lot of organization that needs to happen, not only having the auditions, but being able to gather the data after the audition so that you know who you've seen and are able to use it, right? And so at Malthouse, we set something online, sent it to a few agents, and were absolutely gobsmacked to receive over 850 submissions, of which we needed to give an equitable amount of attention to each audition that came in. And so, you know, the challenge is, where do you find the time? Where do we find the capacity? Where do we find the resources? And then we whittled that down to a smaller list of people that we saw in the room, some people we saw online. It's a lot of work, right? But when we're talking about an access point, you have 800, I think the language we used on the brief was, if you've never been seen by Malthouse before. So what we identified is that 865 people, or whatever the ultimate number was, thought that they hadn't been seen by Malthouse before. Now, there were a good handful of people in that group that we thought, we know this actor, we've seen them, and we know you, but that doesn't matter. That human thought that they did not have access to the organization through any other channel other than a general audition. So what that taught us is that we needed to actually pay attention to where we're creating access and how we're talking about the access that we do want to invite people to engage with us through. And then on the other side, it taught us that there were people who had been excluded from our arts practice. There were so many people that we thought, where has this person been? We've never seen them before. They were amazing. But because we weren't conscious of where our, you know, our circle of influence stopped, we actually had missed, you know, quite a large swatch of actors who were doing great work out there, right? So it taught us a lot about our inclusion policies, our access policies. And at the end of the day, we did actually cast quite a few actors that we only met through those general auditions. Mm-hmm. So you talk about something that's now elevated the, you know, in terms of ROI, there was a clear ROI for the theater. We got some great actors who are going to be fabulous in our shows. We met some great actors who aren't quite great fits for these, but we know exactly where we're going to be able to place them. But also we talked to our community about the access points and the inclusion practices of Malthouse. And, you know, I don't know that everyone who had to watch the videos, you know, and take up all this time would stand up and agree with me, but you can't tell me that if we're based on inclusion and equity and access in our organization, that wasn't the right move to do.
Yeah. And the whole time you were talking then, I'm thinking, please tell me you uncovered something amazing, which I'm sure that you did. So the Malthouse's program this year to see, you know, someone that just has been hiding under a rock, either willingly or not willingly.
And, you know, more often than not, the people that we said, oh my gosh, where have you been? We're the artists who are transgender. We're the artists who, excuse me, have been historically excluded or racialized, people who didn't think that Malthouse cared about them because they had never seen themselves in our media, in our offices, you know, so it taught us a lot of, it gave us a lot of information. It taught us a lot about the way that we operate. and there was a benefit to the organization. And I think a lot of times when we think as producers or executives in the art space, because we're so beholden to outcomes and grants and our boards and things like this, there's so much drive to have an outcome, to have an ROI, to be able to show a tangible response to why we're spending time or energy or money doing something that doesn't quite make sense. And sometimes I think the equitable, the inclusive thing to do, though it's hard, is to remove the desire for KPIs to immediately come, or you know, for the outcome to immediately come from the effort. Sometimes it's a longer game. We have to be a little bit patient. In this time though, we got a quick return.
Yeah, it's a brave new world. And actually it leads me onto my next question quite nicely, because when you look at it from the outside looking in, it does look like Broadway has made some good leaps in regard to, you know, use the term loosely, diversity on the stages, at least. I'm not sure how the Broadway community feel like that, but I feel like they make a really, really good effort. And so I was going to ask you if you could do a bit of a compare and contrast around what they're doing and the success they're having and what we're doing.
Yeah. You know, first, I think it's always so important to identify that there are things that Australia is absolutely doing right in terms of representation and acknowledgement of First Nations people, Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people. That's something that I learned and I saw for the first time here that wasn't happening. You know, the idea of a land acknowledgement is something that's occurred in the last, I don't know, year and a half in the US. So there are certainly things that Australia is doing well and has to share with our arts communities overseas. And it's difficult to measure because in terms of general population representation, the numbers are a little bit different here versus the US. And then you talk about as a sector as a whole, you're going to get a much larger representation of visible diversity. I'll call it visible diversity. So talking specifically about ethnicity, nationality, First Nations status, deaf or disabled, visible deaf or disability. But you know, that's why we have to be patient, right? We need to continue this cycle, if you will, turn the spokes, because we don't have enough community engagement that supports the artists that go to the universities that come out and ready to be able to perform on stage. So just from a numbers perspective, our diversity numbers, our percentages, we're down. We're not as high as what you'll see in the US and the UK. Australia is still very much using diversity when it's required or when it's a fun little thing, as opposed to it really kind of happening authentically. We are still leaning into the idea of what conscious casting looks like and representative casting. So when we're, you know, removing the idea of colorblind casting, because we don't want to be blind to the people's identity that we're putting in roles, they have to be able to bring their own identities into the roles as much as they choose to. So we're starting, you know, to kind of lean into that, where we've seen that occurring more frequently over the past 5-10 years in the US. So, you know, I think there are things that Australia is doing well, but I certainly think that there are ways that we can learn from what's happening overseas. And, you know, we're starting to see, you know, even in the film and TV sector, starting to see makeup and hair people on site who can actually deal with textured hair or darker skin, and that becoming a question that we're asking up front, because we know that we're going to open ourselves up to actors of all colors, as opposed to saying, well, this is the costume, or this is the designer, or this is the this, and they can only do it for these people. So we actually can't have a, you know, a tall woman in this show because we don't have a costume for that. Really thinking around the consciousness of the identity as opposed to pigeonholing. We're getting there.
Yeah. I think your population point was an interesting one. And, you know, the per capita, like, you know, clearly it does look like places like Broadway are ahead of us, but there's the volume of people is different. So maybe you visually see the difference more. And yeah, maybe our population is different, but clearly we have a long, long way to go.
Yeah, there's some really great research, amazing research that has been done by Diversity Arts Australia, and they've analyzed the overall percentage of people of different identity. They've got a list of, I think, 13 or 15 identities, and comparing how represented those identities are in society versus how represented they are in the arts, and then further how represented they are in leadership in the arts. And when you look at it like that, I mean, the numbers are staggering, and you see that you know, 60% of one particular group of people engages in an arts practice within their own cultural constraints. But when it comes to commercial theater, only 2% of them are being represented. And you start to realize it's not that they're not in the arts. It's not that they're not here. It's that we're not making space for them to access, to have access to the work that we're doing, or to make work that is exciting and inclusive of their experience. We're trying to just do what we've been doing. So there are certainly challenges that pose itself. And I think a lot of that research being done by Diversity Arts is a great starting point.
Yeah, that sounds like there's some really glaring learnings to be had from those kind of percentage differences.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Oh, and I guess just similar, but moving on a little bit, talking a little bit about gender identity and the progress we're making with that. So, for example, the use of pronouns, which has become a topic of conversation more recently in Australia. What can you teach us in that regard?
Well, I'm definitely still on the learning part of the scale here as a cisgendered woman. It's a part of my knowledge and understanding that I'm still working to learn about and to mitigate negative impacts of my own personal unconscious bias, because I still just don't know everything. But what I do know, what I do strongly believe, is that by using appropriate pronouns, by using someone's personal pronouns, it empowers them. I saw a line somewhere that said, using correct pronouns can even be seen as suicide prevention, right? That we're talking about allowing people to be themselves. We're you know, going back to our abide principles. It's about belonging and saying that you belong here, no matter how you call yourself, no matter what you say you are. It works. It's good with me. You are you, and you belong. And I think the idea of pronouns can be expanded to things like, how do you like to be talked about in press releases? Do I want to be notified as or known as Black or African American? And when someone comes and wants to write a review about this great show I'm doing, how can I, as a marketing team, equip the critics or the writers with the language that you want to use so that we're empowering them to talk about you the way that you would talk about you, right? So pronouns, descriptors, cultural ties, Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander versus Indigenous or First Nations, really empowering people to share who they are and then to listen and hold on to that. Oh, it's so important.
I was involved in a conversation recently around, you know, what path should we take in this regard? And I'm sure they have some unconscious bias that I don't mean to, but I'm just of the opinion that everyone is welcome and everybody should feel welcome, and therefore they should do what they feel is right for them. And somebody pointed out to me that by me doing working, you know, including pronouns, although I'm saying you guys decide, you do what's right for you, by me doing it, it's saying I'm making it okay for other people as well. And that was a leap for me. And I appreciated that being pointed out. It's interesting.
It's, you know, that piece about normalizing the behavior is kind of like the icing on the cake, right? If we're talking about that, because that is a place where people, everyday people, have the power to create change and to make an impact by just role modeling what you want to see. So whether that's stating your pronouns so that someone else feels comfortable, whether that's recognizing microaggressions that happen in a meeting and calling them in, whether that's saying, hey, that's a really great point, Lyndall, but I think, sorry, Susie, you were kind of making one similar just before. Could you repeat what you said? You know, it doesn't take a vigilante and an activist and a sign and a boycott or anything to make change. Everybody can do it. And there's a group that I work with, Theatrical Intimacy Educators, and one of their models is better is better. So if we're trying to make an effort, if we're trying to make one step forward, even if we're not changing the world, even if we're not, you know, diversifying every stage, if we're just doing it a little bit better, and you have, you know, and if you have a position of power where people can see that, you are actually elevating the industry one action at a time, one head nod at a time.
Yeah, it's win-win, isn't it? And that example that you use then, it really resonates with me, having spent, you know, a career going, you know, we need more opportunities for women, and how come women come up with an idea in a meeting and it doesn't seem to get heard, and then the man repeats the same idea and everyone goes, that's a great idea. Like that example comes up at women's groups time and time and time again, and exactly what you said, where you just, you know, hold it up, call out the person who actually did initiate that idea or that had a really similar idea, celebrate them both, acknowledge them all, and, you know, keep moving. It's a pretty small move for a big change.
Yeah, absolutely. And it says a lot to that Susie or whomever the other person was, that, hey, your voice is important here. Don't stop talking, because we want to hear what you have to say.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. So more specifically, I guess, kind of getting us back a little bit on track, moving forward as an industry, obviously is going to take a bit of effort and investment. So how do we kind of bridge that gap between casting someone where we're acknowledging that they're from what was that language that you used before? I'm going to get it right here. That's historically been excluded versus not casting that person. What's some examples of that, or what do we have to do to bridge that gap? That is the clunkiest question I've ever asked, by the way, but I think you know what I'm getting at.
Absolutely, I got you. I think this goes back to what we were talking about before, this idea that you kind of have to get under the foundation, that it can't just be a function of our casting. It can't be a function of our programming, right? It has to be at the underbelly. So the first decision that I think really has to be made, if we're talking specifically about things like, you know, specifically about casting in this instance, is what story is it important for us to tell? Is it important for us to tell? And I want to note that it's whatever the answer is, it's okay. Is this story a story that we're telling that's going to make people smile and laugh and walk away, but that's going to, you know, the funds from this story are going to allow us to open a drama school or something like that? Like, do we need to make lots and lots of money? Is that the reason for doing this? Is this about telling a story that hasn't been told on stage before? Is this a retelling of a story that's been told a million times before? And do we want to investigate different perspectives of the same human experience, right? So first you have to kind of figure out where you sit in that landscape. And then once you do that, then how you're going to cast a show starts to take a bit more shape. If you're in model one, where you really need to just make, we just gotta be a moneymaker, fine. If you decide to choose the big names, and the big names happen to be all cisgendered white artists who are well known and well loved from audiences, that's your choice, but let that choice be underpinned by what the purpose of the show is. If you've decided that you're going to do things a little bit differently, or even go well outside of the scope, you're going to have to do a bit more work. One of my favorite phrases is, if you want to talk to different people, you got to talk different. So if you want to engage a different group of people to come into your auditions, you've got to think about how you're reaching out to them. You also think about what they're coming into. If you're presenting the audition notice in the same way that you always do, sitting to the same agents, same casting briefs, how you expect to find new people to come in the door, I don't, you know, it's the definition of insanity, right?
That's right. And how do you expect them to, that sense of belonging? Like, how do they feel like they belong if it's how you've always done it and they've never turned up before? So why would they this time?
And if you, and you know, the next step to that is, if you finally decided, okay, you know what, we're going to go out to the churches, we're going to go out to the youth groups, we're going to really go out and find people, but then you expect them to come into the room and be able to perform at the same level as everyone else who's been focused on musical theater for the last 12 years of their lives, that's setting them up for failure. Mm-hmm. So then the extra work begins to, all right, we've got to do training, we've got to offer learning opportunities, we've got to find more time in our schedule to be able to bring them up to speed with the information they need before they get to the first rehearsal, paid, I might add, that should be paid work. But you know, you just have to think a little bit differently. And you know, those, I guess, are some practical ways that you have to decide what's underneath the intention behind the show, and then find ways or energy and time to budget it in. And sometimes you can't. Sometimes you're just doing a show because it's fun and you need to make quick money in order to fund your edgy experimental show that you're going to do next year. And that's okay too. You just have to know what you're doing and why, and really let that those principles lead it.
Yeah, so true. I mean, that's life, isn't it? You know, be def- work out your objective. And once you know what your objective is with any project, then that should inform your strategy and your plan and how you go about it. And sometimes it's a big objective and it's different to what you've done before. It's going to take a little bit more work to execute your strategy and your plan. So, yeah.
Absolutely.
All about objective, I guess. Yeah. So we're sort of wrapping up now. This has been incredibly educational. If you had, I'm going to say one, but there's probably, I don't know, three or five key takeaways that we could just, you know, hold with us to feel a little bit more informed and a little bit more open to these topics and conversations. What would those takeaways be?
My first takeaway would be that we just have to listen. We have to make space. We have to make time. We have to make pathways to listen. I think if the theater community wants to be more inclusive, if we want to hear more perspectives, if we want to see more people coming into the theater, sitting in the audiences, laughing with us, enjoying the art form, we have to listen, because it's quite egocentric to think that the way that we've been doing things all along is the only way to do it. You know, as I mentioned, going all the way back to the welcome, stories have been told on these lands for thousands and thousands of years. We can't be the only way to do it. So really opening up and listening and trying to manage and by really opening up and listening, I think that's the first step. One of the other things that I think goes along with listening is that critical self-reflection of acknowledging who we are, who's not in the room, whose perspectives we're not hearing, whose ideas we haven't championed yet, knowing that there are 1,000 ways to tell a love story. And so opening up our arms to listen and hear those is great. And I guess my last takeaway would probably be that you got to do the work. There are no shortcuts to inclusion. There are no shortcuts to belonging. You just have to do the work. And the work is hard. And I think the number one thing keeping companies and organizations from doing the work is, number one is fear that you're going to do something wrong, fear that you're going to, you know, get canceled or something like that. But I promise you, if you don't try to take a step towards success, you're still going to be where you are. I think that the number one thing that keeps organizations from taking a step is fear. And there's this quote that I don't actually know where it came from, but it says that de-risking failure does not guarantee success. And I think that should be, you know, the motto on every producer's wall. We have to try. We have to do something. We have to engage. It's going to be hard work. It's going to be difficult. It's going to ask a lot of you personally, professionally, consciously, but we have to do the work.
Mm.
Yeah.
I think that fear point is really relevant, because I know it's certainly a topic that I have shied away from because I haven't felt hugely educated in this area. You're very mindful of your unconscious bias, and it feels like a bit of a landmine. And so hopefully by having these conversations today, we've gone some way in, you know, opening up people's hearts and minds on this topic. I've loved listening to you, and you've made it really, really clear. And I actually feel like this is a podcast that needs to be listened to a couple of times to get these big concepts really kind of sinking in. And I think, as we said before, that you're taking these concepts and you're reflecting on both yourself and the organization in which you work. It's been so interesting. Thank you so much. It's just been a real joy to get some really thorough and useful information on this topic. So thank you.
Absolutely.
Now, we cannot let you go without asking our three big love of the arts questions. So I'll start with the one that we really love to hear the answer to, and they've all been so mixed and varied, so I'm really interested in yours. But why does arts matter to you?
The arts matter because they are fundamentally the way that we communicate. They're the way that we tell stories, the way that we share our perspective. They're the way that we gain empathy by seeing the world through someone else's eyes. So, you know, as long as we're a society of people who cares about and takes care of and appreciates the differences in each other, arts will always matter.
That's such a beautiful answer, and really on brand, isn't it? Because seeing the world through other people's eyes you know, for me is what I've just learned today about inclusion and belonging. So thank you. That was a really lovely answer. I'm always interested in where our guests discover their love of theatre or entertainment. Have you got a story along those lines?
In fourth grade, I had a teacher, I won't name her here, but she told my mom at the parent-teacher conference that I talked too much in school and I needed an outlet for my enthusiasm other than the classroom. And so my mom put me in acting classes. So thanks, fourth grade teacher.
Isn't that fabulous? Well, you do talk a lot, but very articulately, and it's been really very, very informative today. So thank you. And our last question, and it is a little bit hard because we're all over the shop with our access to theatres at the moment, but what was the last piece of great theatre that you saw?
Oh man, I've been trying to see everything I can since theater has been back, but I just saw a show at Antipodes Theater Company and it was called And She Would Stand Like This. And it's a modern day retelling of the story of Hecuba and her daughters, but the cast was a cast entirely of people of color, trans performers, non-binary performers, gender diverse humans of all nationalities, ethnicities, races, backgrounds. And it just reminded me like what great theater can be when we give people the opportunity to tell their story their way. So big shout out to Antipodes Theater Company and amazing casting by Reese Velasquez of Evolution Casting.
What a nice bow to tie on our conversation for today. Thank you for that referral or that recommendation. That's really cool. I take it it's not on anymore or...
Oh, it just closed, but keep your eyes peeled because I imagine it's got to make a comeback somewhere.
Yeah, fantastic. Well, thank you for letting us know. We'll put a link to our show notes in that and a number of the other resources that you talked about today, because I think the more education and reading we can all do on these topics is good for all of us. So thank you again, Cecily. It's been so fabulous to talk to you and all the best for 2022.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
And yeah, hopefully if we've gone some way to educating our listeners, then we can keep this conversation front and center as we move through the year.
Absolutely.